Just as we're getting everything ready and the last portions of your offering are being gathered together, let me just point to what I've put up on the screen. I'm not expecting you to be able to follow that in fine detail. And in fact, there are paper copies of this that are put out around the room, which you can pick up later, should you so desire. Before I actually get properly into this, let me just say there's a couple of things I want to do. The first is recommend a couple of books to you. This book, Interceding for Revival, Golden Bowls of Incense, has been written by Julianne Thompson's father. He has a lot of experience within prayer, and I read this some time ago and was really impressed by it, just giving us a really inspirational encouragement to pray for revival. Now, he subsequently updated it. There's bits of this which, in fact, I haven't actually read. So I haven't read every word of the new version. But I really enjoyed the old version. And I can thoroughly recommend it. So if you've got £5 to spare, that's a very good thing to spend your money on. And that's considerably less than they would cost you normally. So can I just recommend that there on the table out at the back? Additionally, I'd like to recommend this book, which is today the one that actually underpins a lot of what I'm going to be saying today. This is Tim Keller's Generous Justice, and it is a superb, inspirational book that will really challenge all our precious beliefs. And I cannot recommend that highly enough to really just promote your thinking around particularly how God's wonderful grace makes us just. So can I just point you to that and say that is a brilliant book to actually get hold of. Now, I'm Andrew, in case you don't know. And my rather dubious task today is to give you an overview of the Gospel of Luke, which we've been studying for some considerable months. And I want to do that by giving you a framework for study and then to dive in depth into one particular strand of that to show you how themes run through books. So I appreciate there's a lot up there and I will go through it. A framework is simply something for you to hang your thinking on. It doesn't mean this is the only way you can chop up the gospel. But this is a way, and I find that if I've got a structure, it really helps me when I'm reading through something to understand more about it. So I can say, yes, I can see now that theme that's going through. So rather than just a general pile of different teachings and instructions and stories and examples, you see, there is a unity to it, and there is something that passes through. So let me just describe it to you, and then I'm going to take one of those themes and follow them through. So you can look at Luke as a gospel which is a bit like a 4x4. It's got four big chunks in it and different ways that you can look at it. So I think when you read through Luke, and this is something that is my own invention, which I've culled from lots of different summaries, it's got four major sections, it's got four major theological themes, it's got four very well-described groups of characters, and four distinctives from the other three Gospels. So let's look first of all at the four major sections, which is the bit I've got in yellow. In fact, it's not come out very well here. You should have yellow, red, blue and green, but you can't see that. You're going to have to take my word for it. Okay, so over on the left-hand side, four major sections. You can look at the Gospel of Luke as a chronological sequence of the life of Jesus. And it starts off with a lot to do with the coming of the Lord. Here's the promised Lord who is arriving here on earth to his people. So there's this big section which is all about his announcing his arrival, his birth, his dedication in the temple. People understanding this is the one who has been promised. The Lord who's been promised throughout the centuries. He's arrived. The coming of the Lord. That takes us up to his baptism. And then there's a major division where his mission starts. So Jesus rises out of the water of baptism and immediately gets taken off into the wilderness, where his His ministry is tested and refined. And from then on, it's all guns blazing, his mission is going. So out of the wilderness he can say, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor. He claims the promise from Isaiah that this is the Messiah, this is the Lord who's come, who's going to release the captive, who's going to transform, who's going to bring in God's kingdom. This is his mission started. But dear brothers and sisters, let us understand it starts with the wilderness. We often want the glory, but we're not prepared to go through the wilderness to get it. In the wilderness, he is tested. He sacrifices. He's challenged. And he wins the battles in the secret place that enable him to go out and conduct the mission that he's called to. How often are we wanting the glory, but not prepared to pay the price in the secret place? To fast, to pray, to test that we believe the scriptures and we're full of faith. And then to move out in the strength and power of that and announce, now the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is with me. I'm not talking about earning God's grace. I'm talking that there is a process that every great hero of faith goes through, and it's called the wilderness. If you are in the wilderness today, do not despise it. It is the place where God will shape and mold you and make you into the person he wants to be. This is your time preparation for ministry. This is your time to take the power of God, to embrace it wholeheartedly, and to say, I don't care whatever else happens. I don't deserve a place in ministry, but I will go through this, Lord, because in going through the place of wilderness, I become more like you. I become the person you want me to be. The mission starts with wilderness. Jesus preaches to the poor. He does amazing things. But then there's a point where he sets his face to Jerusalem. And there's a series of chapters where it's clear. He's saying, now I've done my work. Now I set my face to Jerusalem. He goes to Jericho and he starts the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. All the way through that pilgrimage to Jerusalem, he's meeting with people, he's transforming their lives, and he's saying over and over again, I'm going to die. They don't get it, they don't hear it, even his disciples don't understand it. But he's saying clearly, I'm going to die. And he marches into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry of Palm Sunday. He comes in, and then he starts to cleanse the temple. He tells everybody, you are not listening. He preaches about the tenants and the vineyard. He preaches about the fig tree and says, look, you have not shown the response that you should do. You're missing God's call. Now repent, otherwise it's going to be taken away from you. And the rest of the happening is all taking place in Jerusalem. His trial, his death, his burial, his resurrection, and his ascension all take place then within the confines of Jerusalem. So we've got four major sections within the gospel. There are four major theological themes. Right at the beginning, technology. Four major themes, theological themes. First of all, Luke says, right in the very first verses, O Theophilus, I have set this out as a systematic study so that you may add knowledge to what you've already heard. In other words, lots and lots of eyewitness accounts, but Luke is saying, I've written orderly accounts so that you may have secure knowledge. You know, we all hear stories, but actually, stories are great for connecting, but ultimately, we need to know what the scriptures are saying. We need to know what these stories are about. So Luke has done a job for us in setting it all out to say, look, follow it through, listen to the eyewitnesses, and this is what it means. So there's a systematic theology there for us. There's an explanation and an illustration of the divine plan. This is not just a collection of random stories, which are quite interesting to know. This is the culmination of God's plan throughout the centuries. Jesus says, when he's doing his final bit on earth with the disciples, he meets some on the Emmaus Road, and then he meets the rest of his disciples, and he has breakfast with them, and he teaches them everything that the scriptures say about him. He takes them right the way through. The whole of scripture was about Jesus. And Luke is saying to us, look, this is the culmination of the whole Bible. Jesus says and explains them everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets and the Psalms. The entirety of the Old Testament was leading up to Jesus. And Luke is helping us see that. Then there's a major theological theme about how Christ comes to save us. All the Gospels obviously talk about that, but there's something very special about Luke. Luke redefines it, not in terms of saved or not saved, but lost and found. Loads of parables about lost and found. You aren't on a hunt for God. God's on a hunt for you. We were all lost. God has come to find us. It's amazing. This is here. This is the Gospel of Luke. It's good news. Yes. Jesus said, for the Son of Man has come to seek and save the lost. Last time I spoke to you, I spoke about the parable of the two sons, which we sometimes call the parable of the prodigal sons. We painted a picture of the two different sons, and we painted a picture of how we so often are like the older son. But you know who the true older son is in the parable? It's Jesus. Jesus is the true older son, because in the parable, who bore the cost of the other son returning? The older son. Who had to put his money on the line for the father's promise of accepting that younger son back? It was the older son. Jesus is the true older son who goes looking for the lost son and brings him back. He is the one who pays the price. This is Jesus, lost and found. And fourthly, the major theme is about discipleship. Discipleship takes precedence over everything else once we're found. It's the way to and the way of the cross. There is no other form of discipleship. And it results in a new community that lives that way daily. Those of us who are privileged to hear Joel preach last week at Inside Out had it wonderfully explained. We must daily take up our cross and follow Christ. There is no other way. So four major themes. There are four major character groups. God himself revealed in the Son and the Spirit. Secondly, in this gospel, in a way that you don't see anywhere else, women are revealed as central to the plan, purpose, and ministry of Jesus. Thirdly, the poor, the outcast, the foreigner have a special place in God's affection. We'll come back to this one. And fourthly, there is this huge group, which are the bystanders, who just did not get what Jesus was on about and eventually rejected him. And that's the crowd and the religious authorities. Then there are four major distinctives with this gospel. It is supremely a biography of Jesus, which is topped and tailed with his story of his birth and his ascension, which don't occur in any of the others. It's full of people who come face to face with Jesus. Lots and lots of eyewitness accounts of people who actually met him, spoke to him, and were changed by him. And what's particularly noticeable is the way in which he uses parables to show the true nature of their heart. We'll come back to that too. There's an emphasis upon the spiritual life within the Gospel of Luke. Over and over again, Jesus is seen praying. And it's full of hymns of praise. Zechariah, Mary, Simeon, again and again, these beautiful, overwhelming hymns of praise where God spills out in people's hearts and lives and they cannot keep silent, but they have to speak of the glories of God. And then there are lots of miracles in there, four of which are unique to Luke. A few other random details. It's the one gospel written by a non-Jew. In both this gospel and his accompanying volume, the book of Acts, he shows actually there is no need to fear the Jews. No need to fear the Romans. Both Herod and Pilate wanted to release Jesus. The centurion recognized his innocence. In the continuation in Acts, the Romans came to Paul's rescue several times. And even when they did persecute him, it was in error and they quickly stopped when they discovered they were in the wrong. So this is saying to the people of God, you don't need to fear the Romans who are ruling the world at the moment. So that's the overview. Now let me dig back into the central theme which I want to follow, which is that the poor, the outcast, and the foreigner have a special place in God's affection. Now Luke was a highly respected figure. He was highly educated. He was well regarded as a doctor within society. Yet what is it that Luke picks up almost more than anything else? More than any other New Testament writer, he's drawn by the humility of Jesus, the man who was God, who went in search of the poor, the outcast, those on the margins of society. And this is what I want to focus on right now. Luke was hit by the compassion of Jesus, which was exemplified in Luke chapter 6, verse 36, where Jesus says, "Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful." Over and again, Jesus speaks to the large crowds, but is shown intimately interacting with the outsider who is overlooked, the hidden in society, women, foreigners, sick, children, the disfigured, the alienated. And you know what? He made them glad. Job, who, there's a whole book on Job in the Old Testament. It is a beautiful, beautiful book. Job says of himself, "I made the widow's heart sing." This is the ministry of Jesus, which makes me thankful for him and want to praise him for his goodness. But it also challenges me deeply to say, when was the last time I brought such joy to one who was worn down through years of grinding sorrow? Is that what I seek to do? To bring joy to the heart of the dispossessed? To bring joy to the heart of those who feel they're overlooked by everything that's going on in society? A little person in the midst of big, important people. There's so much to unpack here, and I can hardly begin to do it justice. But let this serve as a brief introduction to following a theme through Luke, and I pray that it will be a word that takes root in our hearts and works itself out through acts of love and mercy. The central parable which expresses this more clearly than anything else is the parable of the Good Samaritan. There are two towering parables in Luke, the parable of the prodigal son and the parable of the Good Samaritan. I've already talked about the first. I want to talk about the Good Samaritan now. You'll find it in Luke chapter 10, verses 25 to 37. I'm not going to read through it because I just simply have not got time. There's so much I want to cover. Now, most people will be familiar with the main points of the story. They've heard it at school many times, for instance. But let me remind you of the context and the story. There's an expert in biblical law who publicly asked Jesus a question which is designed to trap him. This is not someone who's saying, "I'd be quite interested in the answer to this." They're out to trap him. And so often when you look at the parables, look at why Jesus is saying them and who he's saying them to, because it reveals so often the heart of the questioner. Jesus bounces the question back to the man, and he comes out with a commonly held view that the vast set of laws, incidentally, I don't need that anymore. That's okay. The vast set of laws can be summed up with two master commandments: to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. But undeterred by a self-justification project, the lawyer persists and asks again, "But who is my neighbor?" He was trying to whittle down the requirement of the law. If he could reduce it to a bare minimum, then he had a chance of keeping it. What was the least he could do to get away with it and still feel smug and self-satisfied? Well, Jesus responds, as he always does, with a story that shows up the true heart. He says a Jewish man was travelling through a remote area when he was robbed, beaten, and left to die. Along came a priest, and then a Levite, this is one of the temple workers, who assisted the priests, both of whom should have stopped to help because this man was their brother. But they both passed by on the other side, possibly because they felt they had a good excuse why they didn't need to help. It would have been extremely dangerous to stop there. Then a Samaritan comes along. We find it hard to understand just what venom would be in people's hearts when they mention Samaritans. Jews regarded Samaritans as half-breeds, as religious heretics, and they were bitter enemies. Yet when this Samaritan sees the man on the road, he was moved with compassion. He braved the danger to give emergency medical aid. He took him to an inn. He paid for his full recovery, which would have been a considerable amount. It's not much, we might say. But why did Jesus choose to make a Samaritan the central hero of the story? If he had put the Samaritan in the road beaten up, people listening to him would rightly have said, "This is a ridiculous story. No self-respecting Jew would risk themselves for such scum." But by putting a Jew in the road as a victim, Jesus is asking his listeners to imagine themselves as the victims of violence, dying without any hope unless this Samaritan stops to help. How would they want the Samaritan to act if they were in that situation? Wouldn't they want him to be a neighbour to them? Wouldn't they want him to be prepared to cross the racial and religious barriers? Now, who are you in that story? We like to think of ourselves as the Good Samaritan, that we would do something good for people. But actually, we need to see ourselves as the man in the road, lying half dead. What if our only hope was to be rescued by someone who not only did not owe us any help, but probably owed us exactly the opposite? What if your only hope was to get free grace from someone who had every justification based on the appalling way that we treated them to ignore us or to finish us off? Yet isn't that exactly what Jesus has done for us? Why is this so powerful, this story? Jesus isn't just giving us a radical answer to the question, what is love? Though, of course, Jesus is, as he demonstrates that love means meeting material, physical, and economic needs through action, and he won't allow the expert in the law to limit the implications of the command. But he's also radically answering the question, who do we love? By depicting a Samaritan helping a Jew, Jesus could not have found a more forceful way to say that everyone at all in need, regardless of race, politics, class, religion, or any other reason, that person is our neighbour. I've racked my brain to think of a modern parallel, and I really haven't got much, but what I can say is there's a guy who frequently sleeps in the doorway to the Shop East, down in Durham City. Probably many of us have passed him by many times and never even looked at him. Because we're busy, we haven't got time, and we're probably thinking it's his own fault anyway. Now imagine that one evening late you've gone to a shop and you've bought a bottle of wine because you're going to a party. Imagine as you're walking through the marketplace, you suddenly grip your chest because you're having a heart attack. And you fall, and as you fall, you smash your head on the pavement. You land in the gutter, it's raining, the bottle of wine smashes. You are now covered in blood, you are semi-conscious, and you reek of alcohol. People start to walk past you. People look at you and think, well, they're in that state, and they deserve it. Maybe even one of your close neighbours walks past, doesn't recognise you, and continues on. Then the guy sleeping in the doorway to East gets up. He takes the little blanket that he's got around him, probably smelly and dirty, wraps you in it, gives you the one cup of coffee that he's been able to buy because that's how much money he got. He calls an ambulance. He sits with you. He goes to accidents and emergency, and he sits with you all night while you're waiting to be treated. Wouldn't you hope that someone would do that? That's the story of the Good Samaritan, but actually it's the story of Christ and his journey to the cross and his sacrifice for each and every one of us. But you know, this isn't just an invention of the New Testament, a clever story that Jesus has suddenly come up with. It runs right the way through the Old Testament. Listen to this. This is Psalm 68. Sing to God, sing praises to his name. Lift up a song to him who rides through the deserts. His name is the Lord. Exult before him. Father of the fatherless and protector of widows is God in his holy habitation. God settles the solitary in a home. He leads out the prisoners to prosperity. This is God giving us his calling card. When people say to you, who are you? Often you'll give your name and you'll tell people what you do. This is God doing the same. God is saying, I am the Lord. I am father to the fatherless. I am protector of widows. I settle the solitary in a home. I lead out the prisoners in prosperity. Could I substitute my name there and find the same thing? Andrew is father to the fatherless. He's a protector of widows. He settles a solitary in a home. He leads out the prisoners to prosperity. This is God's very nature, and our calling is to reflect the nature of God. In Jeremiah, God says, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understand and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares the Lord. The issues of justice and mercy and righteousness run through the Old Testament in great thick rivers of grace. Within the laws, there were allowances for those who were poor. There were Sabbath year laws. There was the year of Jubilee. There were laws on tithing. Do you know that the Levitical laws required an annual tithe to be gathered in every year to support the work of the Levites? But every third year, an additional tithe was taken, and the entire tithe was put into storehouses to feed the poor as well as the Levites. An entire year's tithe set aside for the poor. As I've said already, Jesus did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law, to sum it up. The prophets spoke, Jesus taught, that a lack of concern for the poor is not a minor lapse, but reveals that something is seriously wrong with one's spiritual compass, the heart. This brings us full circle from the original question that the lawyer asked, who's seeking to fulfill the law himself. But you know what? Our motivation in all this is not duty. Our motivation is not just pity. Our motivation in showing understanding is an understanding of grace. When Paul took his leave of the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, again written by Luke, as he says farewell to them for possibly the final time, he says to them, please remember the poor, and quotes as his reason the words of Jesus, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Preaching on these very words, the amazing Scottish preacher Murray McShane said these words, and they're in a book that was his collected sermons that was written in 1848, but listen to what he says about these very words. Now, dear Christian, some of you pray night and day to be branches of the true vine. You pray to be made all over in the image of Christ. If so, you must be like him in giving. Though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. Objection number one. My money is my own. Answer. Christ might have said, my blood is my own. My life is my own. Then where should we have been? Objection number two. The poor are undeserving. Answer. Christ might have said, they're wicked rebels. Shall I lay down my life for these? I will give to the good angels. But no, he left the 99 and came after the lost. He gave his blood for the undeserving. Objection number three. The poor may abuse it. Answer. Christ might have said the same. Yea, with far greater truth. Christ knew that thousands would trample his blood under their feet, that most would make it an excuse for sinning more, yet he gave his own blood. Oh, my dear Christians, if you would be like Christ, give much, give often, give freely to the vile and poor, the thankless and the undeserving. Christ is glorious and happy, and so will you be, for it is not your money I want, but your happiness. Remember his own word, it is more blessed to give than to receive. It's also worth drawing your attention to the fact that some things never change. The revivalist preacher and pastor Jonathan Edwards wrote a magnificent sermon in 1732 called The Duty of Charity to the Poor. It's lost none of its power today. Its relevance is incredible as it addresses the reasons why we persuade ourselves we don't need to do anything about this. I'm going to put it online with the notes from the sermon today so that you can download it and read it if you want to. In his essay, Shopkeeper's Gold, Miroslav Volf wrote this. Imagine that you have no job, no money. You live cut off from the rest of society in a world ruled by poverty and violence. Your skin is the wrong colour, and you have no hope that any of this will change. Around you is a society governed by the iron law of achievement. Its gilded goods are flaunted before your eyes, on TV screens, and in a thousand ways, society tells you every day that you are worthless because you have no achievement. You're a failure, and you know that you will continue to be a failure because there is no way to achieve tomorrow what you have not managed to achieve today. Your dignity is shattered, and your soul is enveloped in the darkness of despair. But the gospel tells you that you are not defined by outside forces. It tells you that you count, even more, that you are loved unconditionally and indefinitely, irrespective of anything that you've achieved or failed to achieve. In the gospel, we see that. We see it in Zacchaeus. We see it in blind Bartimaeus. We see it in the 10th leper, Naaman the Syrian suffering from leprosy, the widow whose only son lay dead. Over and over again, Jesus approached the widow, the outsider, the foreigner, the overlooked, the outcast. Now what about our day? Who are these invisible people? Maybe some are here now. Are they the ones that no one else will listen to and speak badly of? The despised, the mocked. And what about those that will never dream of stepping foot inside this building? How are they to hear? Back to Volf. Imagine now this gospel is not simply proclaimed, but embodied in a community. Justified by sheer grace, it seeks to justify by grace those who have been declared unjust by a society's implacable law of achievement. Imagine furthermore, this community determined to infuse the wider culture, along with its political and economic institutions, with the message that it seeks to embody and proclaim. This is justification by grace, proclaimed and practiced. Now, if we don't get this, we haven't got the gospel. Before we can give neighbourly love, we need to receive it. Only if you see that you've been saved graciously by someone who owes you the very opposite, will you be able to go out into the world looking to help absolutely anyone in need. Once we receive this ultimate radical neighbour love through Jesus, we can start to be the neighbours that the Bible calls us to be. But if we have understood it, then it must show itself in that same neighbour love. It's not an optional extra, it's at the heart of who and what we are. That's why James could write in his epistle that if not accompanied by action to meet the physical needs of others, our faith is dead. So what about our response to all this? I would like us to consider this. Muslims have a Friday, Jews have a Saturday, and Christians a Sunday holy day. Yet we say we are not religious. Ask yourself, where would Jesus spend his Sunday mornings? The early church met every day in their homes, in their communities, not weekly in their special buildings. Now I understand why we have this place. I deeply appreciate this place, and thousands of pounds of my own money have gone into this place. We've been able to do all sorts of things as a result, but if there is a danger that everything must happen within these four walls, if we must come here to experience the power and presence of God in a greater way than anywhere else, if it's become our destination rather than a refuge for refueling and going out again, if others have to come to this building to get the grace of God and have their needs met, otherwise they miss out, then it's become not our home, but our prison. And we must run from it as fast as we possibly can before it chokes the life out of us. In other words, the force of this message is about being out there, being Christ. And if there's any risk that this building hinders rather than helps us in that, we need to be wise to that. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, did you notice that it was those who had important things to do in the house of God who couldn't or wouldn't stop to help? I just wonder, on our way to this building this morning, are we missing the world that Christ wants us to reach? Well, you've got to answer that question for yourselves. But what are our opportunities to respond to this message and show that we have moved from being the person in the road to the Good Samaritan? Now, you may think, Andrew, everything you've said is a load of rubbish. That's fair enough. That's your prerogative. But if you think there is something of God in it, then your response is to go to God and say, Lord, what would you have me do? These are some of my ideas of steps that we could take. Whenever I've been to Ghana, I have been struck that they never miss an opportunity to give, especially to the poor. Sometimes they name the poor, sometimes they don't. Even in a prayer meeting, they take up offerings. They take up a thanksgiving offering. This is a prayer meeting. Thanksgiving offering. They will then take up tithes and offerings. Then they'll take up an offering for the poor. Last time I was there, it was a guy who couldn't afford a funeral. They took up an offering for the funeral expenses. And these are poor people who just run little roadside stalls, giving generously 3 and 4 times, even in the midst of a prayer meeting. We should have a poor fund into which we're regularly and specifically giving, and that is freely accessible for us to help the poor, and not just within the church. Wouldn't it be great if we had so much money building up in a poor fund that we had to search the hedgerows to give it away? Wait, didn't Jesus tell us something about that? Didn't he talk about preparing a banquet and going out and finding people under the hedgerows? At Christmas, we literally did that. We prepared a meal and we went out into the streets saying to people, "We have food prepared, please come and eat it." Some did, some ran away. But this is the radical love of Jesus. I foolishly offered spare food to someone as he was going in a little container and said, "Take it away, just pop it in your fridge and put it in the microwave when you're ready to eat it." And he looked at me, "You're homeless, you don't have a fridge, you don't have a microwave." That's how far divorced I was from reality for some of these people. Secondly, I think we need to be out in the communities where there is the biggest challenge. The philosopher Nicholas Waltersdorf says, "One has to decide where lie the greatest injustices and where lies the greatest vulnerability. Other things being equal, one focuses one's attention on these." Thirdly, we should be looking for ways to end the causes of poverty. People will always fall into difficulty and will need help. It could be any one of us. God says in Deuteronomy, "For there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brothers, to the needy, and to the poor in your land." Some people are born into trouble. Some people get into trouble. Some people find themselves in situations from which there is no escape unless someone else is there to bend down and lift them out of it. No one should have to endure a lifelong grinding poverty. Maybe you, maybe me. We're going to break bread in a moment. Parents, it's nearly time for you to go and collect your children and bring them back into this so that we can have this family meal together, so that we can break bread together. But there's a number of elements to breaking bread. I'm not going to go through some sort of liturgy with you in advance. I want us to use this as, yes, a time of family, but I want us to use it as a personal response as well to the word. Any stirring of the spirit that God has done within your heart, use this time of breaking bread, and you can go up as many times as you want, to just do that deal with God and listen to God yourself. In preparation for it, I'm going to show a video. And it's of a singer singing a song. And during the course of this song, It's about being transformed by the love of God and taking that to other people. The image he uses is one of those, you know, those telephones where you have two cans and a bit of string between it? Well, he has a similar sort of image, but he's got red cups at either end of the string. There are too many people in our community who are alienated, who will never hear the voice of God unless we take it to them. The furthest away are way on the outskirts of society. I'm asking each of us this morning to seek the direction, wisdom and compassion to share his love. I've brought some red cups. I've put them on the communion tables. It may be corny, but what I want to do is use it as a response to the word. I'm not asking you to take one. I'm not expecting everyone to take one. But if it would help you to have a visible symbol of the word that is coming to us this morning, then please do take one as you take communion. It's worth pointing out I've paid for these out of my own pocket. They're not there for toys for children to play with and demolish. They're not there for you to use to have your coffee in later. But please do take them. The song goes, "The same God who spread the heavens wide, the same God who is crucified, is calling us all by name." I'm going to put this on now. Parents, if you at some point would like to go and collect your children. And then let's just go into breaking of bread. The music team will come up after that and we'll begin to play. And we'll worship